It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Walker revealed a plan today that could eventually close the troubled Lincoln Hills juvenile facility. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has rescinded an Obama-era policy on marijuana prosecutions. That policy discouraged the enforcement of federal marijuana laws in states that had either legalized or decriminalized pot. Currently, seven states and the District of Columbia allow recreational marijuana, and more than 29 states have medical marijuana laws. The move today from the DOJ could have a far-reaching impact across the country. Sean O'Connor is with us now from the University of Washington. He's the faculty director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project and Boeing International Professor of Law. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, what does this change mean for those states that have legalized marijuana?
So it means that it's up to the discretion now of the U.S. attorneys in that state as to how aggressively they want to go after marijuana. It's shifted from under the Obama Cole memo guidance saying to use it as a low priority to now you can use your discretion, and if you want to go after it aggressively, you can.
And this is not a statement that we are now going after marijuana aggressively, but it opens the door for those prosecutors.
Correct. So Sessions could have done something stronger and said, not only am I rescinding the Cole memo, but my guidance now is that this should be a high priority for every U.S. attorney. He did not do that. So what we're going to see is you have to look U.S. attorney by U.S. attorney and try to get a sense of their stance on this issue.
And there's kind of a limbo going on right now, or there has been, where if you're in one of these states that had legalized marijuana, you would be in accordance with state law for possessing or growing or selling it. It varies from state to state, but you'd still be committing a federal crime. Isn't that right?
Correct. And that's true for both medical and recreational marijuana.
Can you talk about the Cole memo now that you mentioned under the Obama administration? What was the intent there? How did that work out?
So the intent was to accommodate the state legal systems. So if you had a state that set up a well-regulated system for medical or even recreational, then that would be a low priority for federal U.S. attorneys unless that business or the activity implicated one of eight special situations, like things like there were firearms involved with the people in the business, or it was being done near schools and children. So long as it didn't invoke one of those eight issues, then this should be a low priority. They could still prosecute it, but they should back burner it.
So states, including your own state of Washington, have taken on various levels of legalization. Has the industry in those states been growing, accelerating, even despite this gray area status with federal law?
It did. I think some people overinterpreted the Cole memo and saw it as a legal safe harbor, meaning that they could not be prosecuted. That was never the case, but there was enough comfort level to then move ahead aggressively. And so the industry now in Washington, Colorado, coming online in California, they're quite big now. And so it's going to be extremely disruptive as an economic and industry matter if this goes back to heavy prosecution and we need to unwind these businesses.
Talk about the federal prosecutors. Most or all of them, I think, left, were invited to leave with the change in administrations, which is not unusual. So these are appointees of the Trump administration in these positions now. What do we expect from them under this new guidance?
Yeah, so you might imagine that as a general rule, they're going to be more inclined towards the Trump session orientation against cannabis and will generally be more aggressive than the Obama appointees would have been. But again, these attorneys are taken from the local communities, and because they're from those local communities, that may have some restraining effect on them because they are in a certain culture and they really have political and other legal futures to think about in that community that they came from.
Sean O'Connor is with us from the University of Washington. He's a law professor there. We're looking at drug laws, marijuana laws in particular, and an announcement from Attorney General Jeff Sessions that the federal government would make it more of a priority for prosecutors in states that had legalized marijuana to prosecute marijuana as a federal offense. Sean, I assume outside the law, you've been watching public opinion. What's been the movement in the public lately when it comes to attitudes toward marijuana legalization?
Well, it really seems that much of the public is quite fine with it. I think it can vary across the country, and you have some states the public opinion is much more favorable than others. But I think a lot of folks are just not that concerned about it. However, I would say that that's in relation to what we think of as sort of traditional pot, which is joints and, you know, things that people smoke, and not necessarily the strong edibles and extractions and things like that. So to the degree it's kind of people just smoking weed, I think most people are not that concerned about it anymore.
We had heard from President Trump on the campaign trail that it sounded like he would leave marijuana laws up to the states, more or less in line with the Cole memo and the Obama administration. Do you see this announcement from the Attorney General as contradicting what candidate Donald Trump had said about the issue?
I do. I think that at a deeper political level, Trump was obviously running on a populist and really more of a traditional Republican states' rights, at least recent Republican states' rights position. And now what's interesting is Sessions is flipping that, at least within his purview, and making strong federal action, almost like the old civil rights days of trying to use the federal government to right some of the civil rights problems. And so you're going to see, I think, Democrats and Democratic-leaning states flipping back to their much older position of being states' rights advocates.
Is there any kind of legal position for a state that has passed a legalization law saying, hey, this is the federal government overstepping its bounds, this is a states' rights issue, and we, the state, have the right to do this?
There is. It's stronger on the medical marijuana side than it is on recreational. So, for example, we still have the Rohrabacher Amendment that's still in effect right now that limits the DOJ from using its funds, appropriated funds, to prosecute medical marijuana when it's a regulated industry. So that makes it a little harder. And there's also the business that in medical marijuana, we don't want the federal government involved in the practice of medicine and what people are doing for their therapies. They can regulate drugs, but the overall practice should be left alone. So that's fairly strong. On the recreational side, it's a little harder to make that argument that this is some sort of core state right, especially when you're looking at something that has been listed on the Controlled Substances Act.
We're talking to Sean O'Connor right now about the Department of Justice decision that rescinds the Cole memo and the impact it could have on states that have legalized marijuana. He's a professor of law and faculty director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision from the Attorney General? What are your thoughts on marijuana legalization? Should it remain illegal, be legalized for medical or recreational purposes? Wisconsin, not one of the states that's done either of those. What do you think should happen here? What should be the role of the federal government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll hear more coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to roll back an Obama-era policy that allowed states to pursue marijuana legalization. Sean O'Connor is with us, professor of law and faculty director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision in states that have legalized marijuana for medical or recreational purposes? Do you think that federal law enforcement should pursue marijuana use and sales as a crime or not? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean, before we go to our callers, it seems like the only thing that would remove a gray area here is Congress. They're the body that could effectively legalize this nationwide.
Yes, that's true. And the two main ways they could do it are either deschedule, where they take it off of the Controlled Substances Act entirely, and Senator Cory Booker has a bill in proposing to do just that, or it could be rescheduled, which means it moves down from Schedule 1, which is the most controlled prohibited substances, down to lower levels where it's easier then to treat them as things like, think about over-the-counter drugs that you can get even without a prescription.
Let's go to our callers now. Owen is with us in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hi, how's it going, Rob?
Good. What do you think?
Well, my biggest thing is the Republican Party historically always talked about eliminating federal government overreach. And so this is a contradiction of their whole way that they've promoted the party for a long time. They always believed in state rights, and Governor Walker always talks about leaving it up to the states. So Jeff Sessions has got a vendetta against people that smoke pot, I guess.
Owen, thanks for the call. And, Sean, you were kind of talking about how this states' rights issue is kind of flipped in the parties here. What do you think of what Owen had to say?
Yeah, no, I think he's right that this is changing, I think, an implicit compact that Republican leadership had with a lot of its supporters and voters, that state and localities should decide for themselves what their policies should be in core police kind of areas like this. And now Sessions is flipping that.
Now, looking at this as a priority for law enforcement, Sean, I mean, do you see some sort of federal effort working with, I guess, the DEA led by federal prosecutors to pursue ground-level users of marijuana? Or is this something that might be more, it may be even more in line with the Cole memo, where they're emphasizing it, but when it goes along with other kinds of crimes, trafficking, firearms, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that in some ways, because Sessions used this neutral position of just rescinding the Cole memo but not ordering attorneys to go after this aggressively, he's getting a lot of political bang for the buck, but the status quo may not change a lot in that, as I said before, a lot of local U.S. attorneys may decide they're not going to prioritize this. They're going to keep going on as it's been going on. Where the biggest damage and effect will likely happen are banks and others who are cautiously moving towards working with cannabis businesses. And this will most likely concern them because they are, if they're national entities, they've got branches all over the place, and they don't want to be subject to different U.S. attorneys across the country. So you may see a real rollback now of the important ancillary businesses that support cannabis businesses. They're going to walk away, and the cannabis businesses will be on their own again.
Go back to our callers now. Deb is on the line in New Glarus. Deb, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think, Deb?
Well, as I told the young lady I talked to, I have a grandson that's autistic, and there's been a lot of forward research with CBD oil, and I think that they need to keep their hands off from this industry. It's obviously a moneymaker. It has been for the states, but more than that, it's a great therapy for people who need it, for more than just autism, for other diseases as well. So,
Deb, thanks a lot for the call. Sean, she mentioned in particular CBD oil, which I always wonder, what is the legal status of that? It's something that is sold over the counter. It's, I guess, a cannabis derivative?
Yeah, so the big problem is that leaving marijuana in the way it's defined on Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act is that anything coming from the plant is then prohibited as Schedule 1. And that's really problematic because the CBDs are not THC. They don't have the psychoactive, psychotropic effect. They're not what you get high off of. They do seem to have some therapeutic benefit. And this, again, is why I've been arguing that we need to reschedule, move marijuana down from that, allow more research to happen, and allow more of a over-the-counter or at least a more regular prescription route for a lot of these CBD health products.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Lisa with us in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I've never used marijuana myself, but I see this as a move by Sessions to assist the private prison industry, which I see as very corrupt and leading to many other issues.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Yeah, people have talked about this, Sean, in terms of incarceration. There have been efforts from left and right to reduce incarceration for things like low-level drug crimes. How does that fit into this?
Yeah, so in fact, I mentioned Senator Booker's bill that he put in, Marijuana Justice Act, earlier, well, last year actually now, and he directly ties descheduling then with also limiting for states that don't have a legal marijuana system, limiting the federal funds they can use to build new prisons, and also then require then the states to look at sentence length, especially for racial disparities that are going on, and to also look at things where people were penalized before this change took effect if his bill went into play. So a lot of people are, in fact, looking at the racial disparity going on and seeing this as problematic, that a lot of white affluent people can smoke marijuana and not have problems, and it's very much been a problem for the minority communities.
At the political level, Sean, we've seen a flurry of states over the last really handful of years legalize either medical or or recreational marijuana. Do you think this move from the Justice Department might slow that trend down?
I'm not sure it'll slow the trend down at the state legislature level, but I do think, again, what you'll see is the really important ecosystem businesses, meaning insurance and banking and, you know, drivers, any of this kind of stuff that needs to help support any kind of business, those people are going to start backing away, I think, more, and that could really hobble the emerging recreational and medical marijuana business in a lot of these states.
Do you think anything's going to happen in Congress anytime soon that will close this issue for the foreseeable future?
I don't, until we see what happens in the 2018 election cycle. And if you see a large changeover of Congress in any substantial direction towards Democrats, then I think there's going to be a serious move by those folks to try to at least reschedule or do something else here. But if Congress stays in the makeup it is, I don't know that there's going to be a strong effort. The most sympathetic angle, I think, for the current Congress will be veterans and people with PTSD, and looking at the benefits of cannabis for a lot of those folks and keeping them off opioids. So that's probably the most promising angle. But otherwise, not till we, and unless we see a change in 2018.
We'll leave it there. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Sean O'Connor, professor of law and faculty director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington. He was with us today to talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to roll back an Obama-era mandate that loosened federal prosecution in states that had legalized marijuana. Earlier today, Governor Walker revealed a plan that would close Wisconsin's troubled and highly controversial youth prison, Lincoln Hills. Today, he detailed a plan that would turn the facility into an adult prison and open smaller youth facilities around the state. Patrick Marley covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the years of controversy around Lincoln Hills. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, first, what exactly is the governor doing here? I've seen headlines that seem to suggest, or Twitter posts anyway, that he is closing Lincoln Hills, but that we're not quite there yet, right?
We're not quite there. What he's saying is that in the next state budget, which would be proposed in 2019, he wants to close Lincoln Hills as a juvenile prison and convert it into an adult prison. That would help alleviate the growing prison population for the adults, and then create five new regional centers that would be like lockups for the teen inmates that are now held at Lincoln Hills. The idea there is that you have better control of the situation when you have a smaller group of people. You can maybe have better staffing ratios, and you can keep the offenders closer to their homes when they're, you know, that give them more connections with their families and the services that they'll access when they're not behind bars.
And we've talked on this show to a Democratic state lawmaker who is calling for basically this: let's use Lincoln Hills as an adult prison, open smaller regional centers. Is this getting support from Republicans and Democrats, this notion from the governor?
I mean, I think it's important to know that this is essentially a Democratic plan that the governor has embraced and, you know, made some modifications to, but really is very similar to things that Evan Goyke, state representative from Milwaukee, has been advocating. So it is it's getting support from Republicans in the legislature who had resisted ideas for the most part like this in the past. It's getting support from Democrats in the legislature though some Democrats are very critical of the timing here. This is just as Walker heads into his reelection bid. They're saying that these changes should have been made long ago and that he's doing them too late.
Yeah, give us a brief reminder, a brief timeline of the problems at Lincoln Hills.
Well, in 2011, they closed Ethan Allen School, which was in Waukesha County. They had declining juvenile inmate population, so they decided to keep all their inmates at Lincoln Hills, which is about 30 miles north of Wausau. That increase in population and maybe a little bit of a culture clash seems to be the genesis of the time when the problems really began to start or significantly worsened at Lincoln Hills. We got a criminal investigation within a few years of that, but even by 2012, a Racine County judge had written the governor telling him about a very harrowing experience he was aware of that he thought needed attention. That the governor says he didn't read that letter, that it was passed out of the Department of Corrections, and the issue was not really addressed at that time. By late 2014, an internal investigation that was very expansive started. That was turned over to the Department of Justice in early 2015. We're this month at the three-year mark of that criminal investigation. It's now headed by the FBI. It's ongoing. We recently learned that two former guards were sent letters from federal prosecutors telling them that they could be charged with crimes for something that happened in March of 2014. We don't know if they're looking at incidents beyond that, but we do know that they've interviewed dozens, perhaps hundreds of people and gathered likely thousands of pages of records as they've done this years-long investigation.
If this plan were approved in the legislature and fully funded, what's the timeline? When would it start taking effect?
So if they adopted it in the middle of 2019, they would spend $80 million to build these five new regional centers. I would guess that within a year or two, they would have those up and running. So we're probably talking 2020 that those would go online, and then Lincoln Hills would be converted into an adult facility. You know, a key portion of the plan here would be to keep the people who work there employed at a state facility. They could either go work for one of these new juvenile centers elsewhere in the state, and there may be one in Wausau or somewhere else close by, or they could continue to work at Lincoln Hills. They would have to get trained as an adult prison guard rather than a juvenile youth counselor, they call them.
Patrick, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this breaking news today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That's Patrick Marley. He covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about Governor Walker's decision that would, if approved by the legislature, close Wisconsin's troubled youth prison, Lincoln Hills, and turn it into an adult facility. You've heard the stereotypes. Millennials are lazy, they're frivolous, they spend money they don't have. But our next guest makes the case that those stereotypes aren't true and that millennials are the products of a difficult economic time. He says the vast majority of millennials are drowning in debt. They're half as likely as their parents to own a home. One in five live in poverty. Michael Hobbs is a contributing writer at HuffPost Highline. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that those stereotypes were kind of your starting point and what ended up being a deep dive into what's going on with the economy and how it's affecting millennials. But your basic case, it's not the millennials themselves. It's the economy they grew up in.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of what you hear about millennials comes down to individual differences. Things like we're more spoiled, we're more entitled, we're more lazy. But when you talk to researchers, there's really no evidence for that whatsoever, that younger generations have always been looked upon with kind of mystery by older generations. Whereas what has changed and what is measurable, and there's a mountain of economic data on this, is that the country around us has changed a lot. So when my dad was in college, he worked 10 hours a week in the library, and that was enough to pay for his tuition. And when I was in college, I worked around 15 hours a week at a video store, and that was enough for around half of my tuition. And then if you look at the numbers now, with the federal minimum wage at around $7.80 an hour, and even public education costing more than $25,000 a year, if you're working 10 or 15 hours a week, that's less than 10% of what you need to go to college. And so when we focus on individuals, we forget these larger structural factors that are really affecting the way that young people live now.
And you write that the Great Recession isn't the whole story here, but it made things even worse for a chunk of millennials, people who graduated maybe 2008 to 2012. They were, you write, passed over for jobs during the recession and then not picked up later. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there's About 50% of college graduates, people that graduated in 2007, had a job lined up when they graduated. By 2009, that was down to 20%. And so at the height of the recession, there were 6 applicants for every job. And so a lot of the advice that we were getting was kind of build a personal brand and do your best and this kind of thing. But fundamentally, in the recession, there were just too many people and not enough jobs. So for this story, I interviewed somebody who graduated in 2009 with a degree in economics. And he tried to get jobs as bank tellers, which was the only jobs that he could get interviews for in 2009. And he just couldn't make it work. And eventually he went back to being a waiter, bussing tables. And now he's a bus driver. And so he's still paying off his student loans. But he really has no chance now of getting into any kind of career job or anything that would let him use his degree. And there's millions of people that are in the same situation.
And that's college graduates we're talking about there. Talk about the high school graduates.
Well, I mean, we tend to focus, when we talk about millennials, we often focus on the college grads and how much harder it is for college grads, and that is objectively true. However, 2/3 of millennials did not graduate from college. And when you think about the economy that our parents and our grandparents graduated into out of high school, there were lots of jobs available that were kind of low-skilled jobs, but you were in a union, you were working in manufacturing, you had some sort of steady, decent middle-class job. And now nearly all of those jobs that don't require a college degree are very low paid. They're much less secure. You're a lot more likely to be hired as a kind of like a consultant. You know, they call you a consultant, but really you're there every day, 40 hours a week. And just the quality of jobs has just really degraded. And so for those 2/3 of millennials that don't have college degrees, things have never been harder.
That's a big point you make as far as the changing economy that millennials graduated high school or college into. The concept of working for an employer who's going to maybe be your full-time career, maybe provide benefits, has been replaced by, in some cases, the gig economy, in some cases by being a temporary worker or working for a contractor for another company. Can you talk about that shift?
Well, what's interesting is we usually think of things like the gig economy, like Uber, as kind of taking over the economy. But right now, that's only about 3% of American workers, whereas people who work under quote-unquote contingent arrangements are around 40% of the workforce now. And that's people that are hired as consultants, and so they're not actually working for the main company. So when you think about a company like Google, they have bus drivers who drive their employees from San Francisco every morning. They have cafeteria workers. They have people who clean their offices. In a previous generation, all of those jobs would have been Google employees. So all of those people would have been on the Google pay scale. They would have been able to get training to get other jobs in Google. There was kind of a ladder of opportunity that would pull them into middle-class jobs from those entry-level positions. And now all of those people are working for contractors. So when you talk to people that work for these kind of contingent arrangements in these companies, there's really no way for them to get into the company proper, like to get into the mothership. There just isn't really a path for that anymore because there's nobody that can say, hey, we have this employee training program, or hey, we have this way that you can apply for an HR position. No one really knows you and no one's really looking at you as an asset or skill. So you're just selling a service. And so this is millions of people in the workforce, and there's just no way for them to get into these companies that will allow them to enter the middle class.
Michael Hobbs is with us. We're talking about the economic challenges facing millennials. Michael, we've talked about the job side. There's more we can get into there. Let's go to the housing side now, though. You write about spiraling housing costs around the country, especially in places where the jobs are.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we've kind of overlooked as a country is the extent to which jobs are concentrating in big cities. So the 100 largest cities in America have added about 6 million jobs since the recession, whereas rural areas in the country still have fewer jobs than they did in 2007. So if you're a young person, you've just graduated from high school, you've just graduated from college, if you want one of those few jobs left that gives you benefits, that pays a decent wage, you really have to move to a city now. You have to move to San Francisco or Boston or Chicago or any of these cities. But the problem with moving to those cities is that housing costs have become so high in those cities that as an entry-level person who's trying to get onto the ladder, all of your costs are taken up by your housing. And so this actually shows up in the data that for workers like this that were moving to high-cost cities in a previous era, Their wages were higher and they paid more for housing costs, but their wages were so much higher that it actually made sense for them to do that. Whereas now the higher housing costs, I mean, think about San Francisco, right? Where a one bedroom apartment costs $3,000 a month. Even if you're getting a decent paying job, you're making $60,000, $70,000 a year, that sounds like a great salary. But if $3,000 every month is going to your apartment, your only option is to really just really struggle for the first decade of your career, or to live, you know, an hour, 2 hours out in the suburbs and have these punishing commutes where it's really difficult for you to kind of enter a career and have enough kind of mental energy to be working as part of your day. And so the housing crisis really can't be separated from the economic structures that we have in the country now, that a lot of people, instead of moving to these big cities where all the jobs are, they're just kind of staying put because they figure, hey, you know, I can't afford to live in San Francisco, so I'll stay in my smaller town. But there aren't as many jobs in smaller towns, and especially there aren't any well-paying, secure jobs in smaller towns. And so these are really the two options that young people face now, and it's a catch-22 for a lot of us.
And you point toward zoning policies in a lot of big cities as part of the problem. Places that, again, the places that have the jobs people are going to want, there's been a long-term bias toward protecting current homeowners and protecting their property values, and that's been preventing any kind of affordable housing from popping up.
Well, what a lot of people don't know is that it's basically illegal to build apartment buildings in the center of large cities. So when you look at the inner ring suburbs of growing, booming cities, places like San Francisco or Seattle, it would make a lot of sense to replace some of these large homes with large backyards with modest 2-3-story apartment complexes or maybe duplexes, or even allowing people to just rent out their basements and have a little bit of extra income. That's literally illegal in a lot of parts of the country, especially in these cities. And a lot of that is because homeowners want to preserve their parking, they want to preserve their neighborhood character. These are things that are understandable, but the fact is these cities are booming. People are moving to these cities whether they like it or not. And so when homeowners say, we don't want anything to change in our neighborhood, what they're basically saying is, we want young people and people that are poor to live as far out from possible and have these long commutes and have their lives be as inconvenient as possible because we don't want to lose our parking. And I think that it's understandable that people think that way, but we all need to make sacrifices and we all need to open up opportunities to people to live closer to cities. Cities have better social services, they have better schools, they have better hospitals. And so what basically wealthy homeowners are doing is they're saying, we don't want anyone else to share in those things, so we're going to keep it illegal to build any homes near these great social services.
We're talking to Michael Hobbs. He wrote a piece for Huffington Post Highline on the economic challenges facing millennials. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a millennial? How are you doing? Are you drowning in debt? Are you facing a lot of student loan debt? Are you able to find a job in a place where you can afford to live? Call in at 800-642-1234. And we're going to get into some of the psychology here. Are you feeling anxious about this? Is this weighing on you, on your mind all the time? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We pick up our conversation now about the financial challenges facing millennials today. That's people born between about 1982 and 2004. Our guest is Michael Hobbs. He says millennials have the worst financial luck since the Great Depression. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a millennial, or maybe your kids are millennials? What do you think of the economic landscape they're facing? If you're a millennial yourself, are you stressed about all this? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Go to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hey, yeah, so I'm a registered nurse. I've been so for over a year. I'm 23 years old, and I'm working 3 part-time jobs just because full-time jobs are so lucrative because of insurance. And then I'm actually lucky enough right now to have one of my part-time jobs offers insurance, but it's crazy expensive to the tune of $500 a month. You know, rent's crazy if you want to live somewhere where the roof doesn't leak. All the bills associated with modern living, I'm thinking cell phone, car insurance for a 23-year-old is impossible. I've never been in an accident, but because I'm a young male, they just take my arm and my leg for insurance. Yeah, but then even working as a nurse's salary, I still feel as though like I'm barely living paycheck to paycheck, especially after taxes. And so then I don't know how people, I don't like $7.25 is not a living wage. I'm not even sure $10 is a wage. And then you throw on the price of groceries. If you're trying to eat healthy, it's four times more expensive than the processed garbage. And that's how I feel, overwhelmed and dead inside as a millennial trying to make it in this modern society.
Jacob, wow, thanks a lot. Michael, a lot there. You've heard a lot of stories like that. I want to go to his last point there. He feels overwhelmed. He feels dead inside. This is not just an economic story. This is a mental health story almost, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, you can't see me, but I'm like violently nodding. I mean, I talk to so many people in the same situation. And what's really interesting about Jacob's situation is that healthcare costs are out of control. The healthcare industry is wildly profitable, and yet it's creating these jobs where somebody has to have three part-time jobs with a degree just to make ends meet. And so there's a fundamental breakdown in the economy, that there's a lot of industries that are doing really well, but the people who work in those industries are not doing well. And I think there needs to be a much bigger cultural conversation about this.
Jacob, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Dustin on the line in Eau Claire. Dustin, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I think this really segues well into what was just being said, a mental health issue and also a policy issue. I mean, a lot of us millennials are feeling like, you know, when you turn 18, you get invited to a leadership table and you're able to vote, and you're able to do those things. But I don't see policy going into our favor very well on a grand scale. You know, as mentioned before, we talked about, you know, policy that stops us from developing larger cities, giving people opportunity to live in those areas. And I really feel strongly that more millennials need to get involved with the conversation that we're having about policy and start doing things, you know, at a leadership level that really benefit us.
Dustin, thanks for that call. And Michael, you make that point yourself toward the end of your piece.
I mean, I think the biggest thing to know is that, you know, there's no scenario for fixing what's been done to us that doesn't go through higher youth turnout. And what a lot of people don't know about youth turnout is that we all know that it's lower than the boomers, millennials should vote more, blah, blah, blah. But some states have 70% millennial turnout and some states have 30% millennial turnout. And what that means to me is that it's not youthful disaffection or that young people don't care about politics. It's that it's harder for us to vote. And you see this in the statistics too, that once millennials are registered to vote, we vote just as often as boomers. The problem is getting us registered because we're more likely to move around. And so we need to take back this country, basically. I mean, I watched what was going on with the GOP tax bill the last couple weeks with a pit in my stomach, like a lot of other millennials. And this is a giveaway to boomers, and it really hurts young people. And what we need to do is we need to be more active. I completely agree.
Thanks for that call, Dustin. Michael, I think a lot of times when people think about their personal financial problems, it's that. It's personal. It's my own individual problem. It's not a collective problem. It's not a society problem. It's not a policy problem. Do you think that keeps people from getting involved in trying to set policy?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which the thumb is on the scale in favor of corporations now. And I don't think we really realize things like classifying your employees as independent contractors when de facto they're employees is actually illegal. And a lot of attorneys general have gone after companies that are doing this too aggressively. A lot of people don't know that wage theft, the thing where your boss makes you come in early to get your uniform on, is also illegal. People don't understand, I think, or it hasn't been told to us, that a lot of these ways in which we're being exploited are actually illegal. And if more people knew about them, they'd be really shocked and offended. And so I think we need to push this cultural conversation to people older than us, especially who haven't worked in entry-level positions in a really long time, to get them to understand that it is objectively more difficult for young people now than it has been since the World War II.
Talking to Michael Hobbs about a piece he wrote on millennials and the economy they live in. Back to your calls with Beth on the line in Rosendale. Beth, hi.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to offer an alternative perspective. My husband and I are both millennials, and we're actually really well off. We do live in a rural area, and my husband commutes 45 minutes. I commute about 25 minutes, but you know, I think I talk about the secret to our success is when we went to college, I have a 4-year degree, my husband has a 2-year degree. We focused on paying off our debt before we made any big financial decisions. And so because we don't have any student debt, we drive older cars, We've really been able to do pretty well for ourselves, and, you know, we're pretty comfortable. We're having a baby on the way, and we already have one child as well. So just to say kind of that not everybody's in this situation.
Beth, thanks for the call. Congratulations on all that and the baby coming up. Be careful commuting out of Rosendale. Watch out for the speed traps there. Michael, not everybody's in the same boat here.
I mean, that's important to acknowledge. Not every single millennial is having these problems. But what's interesting is when you look at the inequalities within millennials, what you see is that the defining inequality between millennials who make it and millennials who don't are the millennials that got help from their parents. So there's a huge gap between white millennials and millennials of color, mostly because the average white millennial has about 86 times more intergenerational wealth that they can draw on. So oftentimes when you hear stories, I don't know what Beth's situation is, and I'm happy for her, but oftentimes in stories of kind of millennials who made it, oftentimes you find that the parents helped pay for college, the parents helped them get out of debt, the parents helped them with their medical bills or with their rent the first couple of years that they were out of school. And that's really decisive for kids that don't have student debt coming right out of college. That's an extra $300-$400 a month that they can use to invest in themselves or take on a slightly riskier job that's going to lead to a better career. And so we need to look at these inequalities within millennials, and systematically, millennials of color do not have as much of this intergenerational wealth to draw on, and that can be really decisive.
Beth, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, I want to spend our last few minutes talking about possible solutions. You lay out a lot of problems, and you also in your piece talk about what could be done about them. Can you give us some of your priorities?
Well, this is the only part of the article that is not extremely depressing. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of cities are doing really interesting work. So San Francisco passed a law that's stopping these exploitative scheduling practices. We all know dozens of states have done higher minimum wages. There's lots going on. There's even a big housing plan that was announced this morning in California to build more housing. There's all kinds of things going on at the local level. And what you see is these activist groups forming at the local level that are starting with city councils, they're starting with mayor races, and really putting these issues onto the agenda. So in 9 of the 11 biggest cities in America, renters outnumber owners. And that's becoming a big political constituency, finally. And so you're seeing all of these other movements forming, mostly driven by millennials who are just really tired of these economic circumstances and want to reverse it.
Do you think we were talking about millennial voting earlier? Do you think with those trends you're seeing on the local level that 2018 potentially could be a big year for millennial voter turnout?
Yeah, we saw it in Alabama. We saw it in the UK, where younger people were much more mobilized to vote. I think when we hear a message that we really want, that resonates with us, and we're hearing people who are like us that are running for office and who are speaking to our concerns, we show up. And especially, you know, Oregon did automatic voter registration and also has mail-in ballots, and they have really high millennial turnout. So what we need to do is get better and easier voting procedures to make it easier for people that have two jobs to show up and vote. And that's what the political agenda needs to be.
And then you also write about trying to match policies to the working reality, things like, you know, most people aren't getting health insurance, or fewer people get health insurance through work now. Do we need to rethink how health insurance and other benefits, for that matter, follow people from job to job? As we wrap up, do you think there are policy solutions there?
Yeah, well, look, one type of employees is expensive and one type of employees is cheap. And what you see is companies switching from the expensive employees to the cheap employees. And what we need to do is bridge that gap to make sure that every employee gets benefits, whether or not they're an independent contractor, and every person gets a safety net underneath them, even if they lose their job. And that's where we need to go.
We'll leave it there for now. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Michael Hobbs. He's a contributing writer for HuffPost Highline. He joined us to talk about the financial challenges millennials are facing around the country. We have a link to that piece that Michael wrote. It's over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can keep the conversation going there if you're a millennial, if you have millennials in your family. Love to see their stories there. What is their personal economy like? How are they doing in the job market? Being able to afford houses, that kind of thing. Was the story you were hearing your story or the story of your family? You can let us go. Just check out Michael's piece and share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. With a new year, new laws are taking effect in states and cities around the country, and there's one in Oregon that's gotten a lot of attention. That's the state of Oregon, not Oregon, Wisconsin. Through the end of last year, you could not pump your own gas in the state of Oregon, full serve only. Oregon was one of only two states with that kind of law on the books. It was Oregon and New Jersey. As of New Year's Day, New Jersey stands alone. There's been a lot of social media activity on the Oregon self-serve law. Oregonians? I don't know that one. I'm going to go with Oregonians. They've been a little nervous, like expressing their fear and concern about having to pump their own gasoline. And the internet being what it is, residents of 48 other states have been making fun of Oregonians being worried about pumping their own gas, saying basically, hey, we've been doing it for years. It's not so bad. I was just out in Oregon last summer, and I was baffled. I pulled in, you know, with the rental car to get gas and hopped out. And where do I put my credit card? How do I do this? Until the gas station employee came up and did it for me, which was kind of nice. And then on a road trip over New Year's, as I was pumping gas at an oasis in Illinois in, what, 0 degree weather? Yeah, full serve sounded pretty good, but we got what we got. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.